You heard the man, 63 degrees already, heading for near 70 today. Whoopee, I do believe spring is here for a while, but why do I see a little bit of mention of, I'm not even going to say the word, Kyle, I'm not going to say snow flurries, because I don't believe it's going to happen to you, huh?
I really hope not.
Really? I see you got your woolen cap off. That's a real good sign.
I do.
First time since last October. Good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you here. Thank you so much for being with us here. We always strive to bring you a program worth your time, worth your while. We try to mix in or blend elements of information and entertainment. We think we have the prescription for you today. So glad you're along for the ride. Kyle, let's see. I want to ask you something. Can you imagine a time when you go home tonight, no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no nothing? It's not because of a, God forbid, a storm or something. Just the way life was. Can you imagine that day in and day out without those things?
No, especially not the plumbing.
How about that? I think the plumbing really gets you, doesn't it? Huh? But the juice, the electricity is kind of a big deal, too. Well, you know what? We all say it from time to time. Oh, for the good old days when things were easier and simpler, less complicated and less congested. The good old days. Kind of wishful thinking, really. How much good was there in the good old days? Let's take the 1920s, the 1930s and 40s, even into the 50s, around here in our region. Sure, there were plenty of good things about life back in the early decades, say, of the 20th century, but there was a not-so-good side, too. Thanks to a new book, we get a look at both sides through the eyes of a western Wisconsin farm family that lived that life, that weathered the sunshine and the storms, literally and figuratively. The name of the book is The Crops Look Good, News from a Midwestern Farm Family. It's mostly about people and place. It's told through the letters, yes, letters, written by members of the Willie Williamson family of Polk County, Wisconsin. They farmed near the town of Centuria during the first half of the 1900s. Two parents, nine children. Their letters reveal a life that most of us, Kyle, would scarcely recognize today. Wow. Their lives were ones of joy and dreams, hardships and sorrows, unceasing physical labor, and somehow a triumph of the human spirit to keep on going, keep on hoping for better outcomes, and holding on to one another, even across long physical separations. Author Sarah DeLuca is the daughter of Helen, one of the nine Williamson kids. Sarah built her book around those letters I mentioned, a vivid time capsule they are of a long-ago moment when the written word bound people together and chronicled the ups and downs of everyday life. Sarah, welcome to the show. Congratulations on an excellent book. Wow.
Thank you so much, Stan. I'm really delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. You know, I got to admit to you right off the bat, reading the book, I felt at times sometimes like a bit of a voyeur, looking in on people's lives of long ago. And it made me, you made me feel comfortable with it as the book goes on, because these are people with whom I could identify. They're a lot like my mother's family, Norwegian immigrants, eight kids in the family, grew up in a small little hamlet on the plains of Saskatchewan, Canada, had next to nothing in the way of material goods, but they you know, scraped out a life that they could be proud of and all the rest. And as I read the book and remembering them and learning about your aunts and uncles and grandparents, I at times felt selfish and ungrateful. We have it so easy in so many ways in this day and age compared to what they did. And Sarah, the interesting thing is they didn't think of themselves as extraordinarily different from other people back then, did they?
No, they weren't. I think this family story is very representative of that time and place, and everyone struggling to better themselves, make a better life for their children, and working very, very hard, seven days a week, no vacations.
No. We'll hear about that.
Right.
You're going to read us an excerpt. Olava, who was the mother of the family, and your mother, Helen, was one of the, as I said, one of the nine kids of Willie and Olava Williamson. The name was actually Wilhelmson, wasn't it, before it was anglicized?
Yes. They did immigrate soon after the Civil War, when we had that big wave of immigration.
Right.
many, many people from the Scandinavian countries came at that time. Mm-hmm. And Wilhelmsen became Williamson.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the farm is still there. It's not too far from where we're sitting right now. Right? It's St. Croix Falls, kind of, you know, that area, just inside Wisconsin, not too far.
Yes, it's Highway 35, and they're kind of right between the little villages of Centuria and Milltown.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we want to ask you about how you got started on this project. I'm so glad you did it, this book called The Crops Look Good, or A Remembrance of Your Family. This all begins with a trip you made in the 90s to see one of your aunts, right?
Yes, my oldest aunt, Margaret, she'd been living in California for years, and then she and her husband retired to Mesa, Arizona. I went there to help her clean out her household. She mentioned a box of letters that actually was under the mobile home.
And a crawl space, maybe. Huh?
I crawled in there with the critters and fetched it out. And what a find. I mean, two big boxes, actually, of letters she had saved all the way back from when she left home in 1923.
Wow.
And the letters went up through the 1950s. Mm. She saved most of them. Oh. And what a treasure it was. I was really amazed to see what history we had there.
Not a text message in the lot.
No.
We wouldn't have this cache of wonderful memories.
That's right.
Living in the time we are now, because the delete button would have destroyed all of it. So Aunt Margaret's letters, so you fell into this wonderful treasure trove of family history. You recognize it as such, that from these letters you could do something. Mm-hmm. But you were, there was almost a little fear in you of what to do with them. You knew you wanted to write about the family, but you couldn't get the traction right away.
Well, it was an overwhelming project.
Sure, sure.
The amount of material. The first thing I did was transcribe it all. That took me 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I set it aside for a while, trying to kind of decide what the next step would be. Mm-hmm. And it actually took me going on 10 years to do this, because I'd set it aside, think about it, make some missteps and wrong turns in the project. And
welcome to the world of writing.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it is.
And rewriting and rewriting.
What did Hemingway say? When you write, you've got to open a vein and bleed.
I think
his last sentence in A Farewell to Arms, he wrote and rewrote 20-some times. Just that one sentence to end the thing, Kyle. So it's hard work. Writing well is hard work.
It's very hard work.
You've expended the hard work, and you've come up with a wonderful book, too. You got the letters here, so you decided finally to get cranked. And it was a tough, you had a very almost enviable problem, because you had so much material, you had to throw out some stuff. Better than to have scraping to put together a book out of too little, you had too much.
Yes, that's a good problem to have.
It is. Mm-hmm. But you did it, you winnowed, and through your writing, you have taken these letters from your various aunts and uncles and grandparents, and you have woven them together with accounts of what was going on in the world. Say that your Aunt Margaret writes a letter in 1924. You're telling us what's going on contemporaneously, maybe in this region and in the nation and even around the world. And so we have context. Thank you very much. And it makes it a fascinating story, a multidimensional kind of story, too.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that it comes across that way, because that was my goal, to give it a broader context. I wanted to not only tell this family story, but represent the entire family farming culture. And of course, we're all part of something bigger, so we need to connect ourselves with the region and the world, and it all works together. So that was my goal in writing the book.
Think of the times, the challenges, the crises that these people of those times went through. We're talking about in the 20s, 30s, 40s.
Yes.
The Great Economic Depression. Horrible thing, and it really impacted everybody, especially the farmers, too. No doubt about it.
Oh, absolutely.
And we had the stock market crash, part of that deal, of course. A drought, soil, topsoil blowing away, the dirty 30s, as they were called.
Right.
Unbelievable heat in 1936 and 7. Grasshopper plagues.
Right.
Grasshopper plagues. The farmers used poison that was as toxic to them as it was to the grasshoppers. Just using that stuff was so unsafe. And you mentioned that farming itself was a very dangerous business back then.
It was. I think it still is. But in those days, you know, you didn't have much in the way of safety measures. Right. People were working with big animals, dangerous equipment.
Right.
I think that's still true to some extent, but perhaps we have a little advantage now with the better technology.
Your grandma Olava, from one of her letters, it's amazing. You kind of synthesize from it what life, daily life, was like for her. And if you could just kind of help us here by reading a part of your book here about what the mother of nine kids went through on probably a routine day.
Yes, I'll just read a short excerpt here. Olava's life is so lacking in recreation. Her days are filled with heavy work, pumping, hauling, and heating water, cooking and baking with a wood-fired range, gardening and preserving fruits and vegetables, cleaning the house, maintaining the yard, sewing, knitting, patching, scrubbing, and ironing clothes. Looking after a large family in a small house with two bedrooms and no plumbing, central heating, or electricity. Like most of her neighbors, Olava was a daughter of Norwegian immigrant farmers. Her father, Ole Ralsted, suffered ill health and died at the age of 30 on July 2, 1875. Olava was born 4 months later. She grew up knowing two very different worlds. Her primary home was a humble pioneer farm of her maternal grandparents in Eureka Township, Polk County. Olava also witnessed the luxurious life of the wealthy Charles A. Pillsbury family in their Minneapolis mansion, where her widowed mother was employed as a housemaid.
So she had a window for a very brief moment on the other side of society of life. So what were her impressions of seeing the Pillsburys?
Well, she talked about that to me even when I was a young girl and talked about what a beautiful home they had, all the toys the children had, the very elegant meals, the relaxed conversation, all the company, and, of course, the domestic help. She got to play with these children. There were a couple of young boys, the Pillsbury twins, and they stayed in touch with her all her life.
They did.
They wrote letters. They always remembered her birthday. Wow. She was so proud of that. But I think, in a way, seeing this other side of life put a sadness in her, too, because she was aware that things were easier for some people. And she longed for the beautiful things, but really never was able to have too much of luxury.
So common at the time, too, for most people back then. The nine kids, the oldest, Raymond, and then came Margaret, then Adele, Leland, Clarence, Wilmer, Donald, Helen, Alice. Helen being your mom.
That's right.
All right. Raymond, among the boys, he was going to be different. He was not going to farm, was he? The other guys, the other sons said, okay, farming, either intentionally or otherwise, is going to be my life. But Raymond struck out to be kind of a business. He wound up at a bank initially, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. He was a brilliant student. Well, they were all good students, but he was just exceptional. He decided he wanted to go into financial work, and he went into banking. And for a while, he was in the radio business, too, when radios were just becoming popular.
And selling radio sets, right.
He set up a radio shop for a while. It seemed that nothing went quite right for him. But
This was a hard luck guy. Raymond had great intentions, was a good student, a bright guy, had ambition, all the rest of it, but he couldn't catch a break, could he?
Timing was bad in a lot of cases. Just nothing quite went right.
One day he comes home and talks about the son of his boss who has committed suicide. And this really, really impresses him. Depresses him and impresses him. And there's an irony in there, isn't it?
Yes,
Sarah?
There is, because he felt so bad for his boss, and the whole family felt bad. You know, how can you recover from losing a son that way? And then Raymond takes his own life later on.
He does. So he felt himself, like the other young man, a failure And he didn't know how to deal with it. And
I think so. I mean, we don't.
It's the
heavy burden that the family always carried. I think you'd never really recover something like that.
You never get over a wound like that. And the other kids, too. Well, Margaret, the rest of the kids, well, in varying degrees, had, they scratched out pretty good lives. Margaret, the oldest of the girls, she left home in the early 20s and went to Minneapolis, right? Got a job as an optical company?
Yes.
Keeping the books.
There was a company called Wallman Optical in Minneapolis, and she became a bookkeeper there and really loved it. She loved her city life there, and she went home on the Greyhound bus whenever she could.
It's back in the 20s, right?
She left home in 1923.
They called their home the farm. The home place.
Yes.
The home
place was kind of one word.
Okay. Right.
Said very lovingly.
Yes.
Right.
But when they went away, even if it was just to Minneapolis, there was an element of homesickness there.
Yes.
And it's interesting in your book here, you talk about the girls, Margaret, Adele, Helen, Alice. When they found the man of their dreams as very young ladies, the infatuation, the rhapsody comes through in their letters. And it's just, I thought to myself, these guys can't be this good. And in some cases, they weren't. they were so lost in their infatuation and their imaginings that they had found the perfect guy.
Yeah.
And in a couple of cases, it worked out. In a couple of cases, it was really devastating.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that hasn't changed over time and place
is
falling in love.
I want to ask you about your mother, Helen. Precocious little lady. We start reading her letters when she's writing to Margaret, writing from the home place in western Wisconsin to Margaret, who's in Minneapolis.
Right.
And a precocious young lady, 7 years old about there, six, seven.
Mm-hmm.
Very fine writer. Now, I want to ask you, here's your mother. Many years before you were born, what was it like being introduced to the little girl who would become your mother?
Oh, I love this little girl.
I know. I bet you did, huh?
She was so spirited.
Were you surprised by her letters? You'd never seen these before.
I was a bit surprised at how well she wrote at the age of seven. And she went to a one-room country schoolhouse, which they all did. One teacher teaching grades 1 through 8. The children, the older ones, had to help the younger ones. But at the age of 7, she's writing very well. Complete sentences, not too many misspellings.
No.
And expressing herself really well. My own grandchildren at that age, very bright kids, I don't think would be writing at that level. I really don't.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I love this quote I picked for the first chapter. It's from Thoreau. When a writer has something to say, it falls from the pen as directly as a stone falls to the ground.
Right.
Henry David Thoreau. And that's how they wrote, directly as a stone. Just said their minds, and it came out very clear. Very direct.
Kyle, you communicate a lot. Kyle's in his early 20s, and you communicate by smartphone. You do texting and all that sort of thing, right? Do you feel it's any notion about letter writing? Does that ever occur to you that it happened years ago, and that was the main way people communicated? Apart, even some people didn't even have phones until the 50s or 60s in this country. I know that sounds, but. Are you satisfied you can stay in touch and express yourself?
Oh, absolutely.
How about a lasting effect, though? What about somebody 50 years from now coming across your communications? They won't be there, will they?
No, probably.
They'll be deleted.
Yeah.
Maybe what you wrote today is gone in an hour.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. I mean, aside from early childhood things in school.
That your parents and teachers kept, right?
Well, right.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's really nothing.
That's what troubles me. I don't know if you ever think about that or that bothers you, but to have a record like Sarah DeLuca does and her family from these letters, it's precious. It's gold in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You really get to meet these people if you read this book here. It's just amazing. You're walking into their lives through their own words. And I'm sure you express yourself. I know you express yourself very well, but what you say or write and send out there by the handheld device is soon gone.
Yeah,
and it's kind of bad. Sarah, that bothers me. we're losing a record.
I think
the delete button is the biggest enemy of history. I really do.
I just don't think people take time to write these long, thoughtful letters. the way they used to. You know, we communicate differently.
And, yeah, we do.
And some
we
things
do.
Are better about it, some things
yeah.
are not,
yeah.
because we can communicate much more broadly with more people and more efficiently, if you're talking about time, but not as deeply. Some of these letters are 18 pages long. And of course,
look at Kyle.
All written in longhand in a stubby pencil. Or
probably, again, no interior heating, and it's 22
right.
below outside,
right.
and they got the stubby little pencil,
right.
and they're writing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's their only link to the outside, to connecting with somebody else,
right.
whom they really love, you know, a sibling somewhere.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing, though?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you don't think of it. And again, I'm not demeaning what you and your generation do at all, because you communicate faster, you know, than I can. But I'm wondering about the lasting quality, and if you allow yourself time to put some thought into what's being said.
Well, I definitely think, you know, the instantaneousness of mm-hmm. of the communication now, it, you know, back in the old days, you had to write these long letters because it took how many weeks to
right.
to get there.
Right, and sometimes mm-hmm. that long.
That's a long time. A lot of stuff happens in that
time.
That's
true. By the time your letter gets there, things have changed.
Right.
But that's all they had. But there's something precious still about the written record that you leave behind.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people were writing letters, maybe this family more than most, because they had members who had moved away, and that was their way of keeping in touch. Now, they did get a telephone sometime in the late 20s, but my family that I grew up in, we didn't get the telephone till 1953.
And you were not too far from here.
Right,
right.
Right. But it depended. If you were on a main road like Highway 35, you could have that sooner, but on a country road, it might take a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
But with the letters, well, phones were expensive. You just didn't make a long-distance call very easily. It had to be something pretty urgent, mm-hmm. even if you had a phone. That was an expensive thing to do. And once it changed in the 50s, that's when the letters dropped off. I noticed the letters really diminished, became shorter, and then stopped altogether once those phones became more available.
And with email, the post office can tell you that that's why they're going out of business, or seem to be.
Exactly.
It's true, because letters mm-hmm. don't exist mm-hmm. by and large anymore. And again, Kyle, we all understand the benefits of instantaneous communication. It's wonderful. It's life-saving in many cases, too. It really is.
Yes.
Somebody's car goes into a pond, and they're sinking, but they get on the cell phone or mm-hmm. send out a text, and they can save their lives and the lives of others.
Yeah.
So the upside is terrific. And then
sure.
we're talking about a certain downside, I guess, in terms of history and remembering. So it's an interesting kind of a dichotomy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes,
yeah.
it is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we want to ask you, too, why did the women do all the writing back then? You know, the brothers did some, but not like the gals did.
Well, I think in the past, at least, the women were more the keepers and carriers of personal history. Men tended to do more of the public writing, perhaps.
Hmm.
That may have changed some by now, but they would take their quiet time while the bread was rising, or maybe the baby was napping, and sit down and do this meditative kind of writing. The men on the farm, at least, probably were just out there slogging it out all day long.
Sure, men were.
And too tired to even think about it when they came in.
Even Willie, who mm-hmm. the father, who Papa, as he's called by his sons and daughters, you know, a religious man, but he didn't have time to go to church on Sunday. He was saying, I got to go out in the field. Or he couldn't go to funeral sometime. I got to go out in the field.
Well, that's true. And sometimes you couldn't get there, you know, in...
Yeah.
Snow-clogged roads or muddy spring roads. It was pretty hard to get there.
Sarah DeLuca has written a wonderful book. You've got to read it. The Crops Look Good, News from a Midwestern Family Farm. Through their letters and through the context, Sarah, that you provide for us about the times outside the Williamson family, what's going on in the world, in their immediate world, and then beyond that. You've also done some poetry, too, haven't you?
Yes, I have. And in the course of writing this and a memoir that I wrote previously, I started studying poetry because I wanted to have more music and rhythm and condensed writing.
Mm-hmm.
Those
get rid of those adverbs and adjectives
right,
and
just get right to it.
Yeah.
And I think poetry can improve all writing.
True.
So I started studying poetry, and I worked with a wonderful Minnesota poet named John Caddy. He lives in Scandia. Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And when I was living here, I've been in Atlanta area now for 13 years, mm-hmm. but I had the privilege of working with John for years on poetry. And so I have put a couple of different collections together and had them published. But if I could read one short poem.
Please do.
Mm-hmm. It
from your collection called Shearing Time.
Shearing Time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My family had sheep as well as cattle, so have a lot of sheep in this book. But this one is called Sunday Drive. I think it is representative of how people took their recreation on a Sunday afternoon.
Back when, would this be?
Back when. This
okay.
Is, well, my girlhood in the 50s. The Sunday drive was an indulgence, verging on recklessness, unplanned. It just happened now and then, decades ago, on summer Sunday afternoons, beginning with Daddy's quiet, almost shy suggestion that we might go out driving to compare the neighbor's crops, you know. That was the stated reason. But we often traveled way beyond our section through a town or two, or even three. We might expend two precious hours and a tank of gasoline, risk puncturing thin tires on coarse gravel roads, take chances with small rocks that shattered windshields in a heartbeat, unsettling incidents that could not be controlled. Mama, Daddy, all five kids piled into the DeSoto, and we headed out, contained in our own freewheeling world. Probably we'd drive right by an uncle's farm, not even stop or wave, and risk the possibility that he might spot our vehicle and later question our strange liberty.
What were you doing out driving on a Sunday
there
afternoon?
There were some crab reviews along the way conducted by our mother, who craved purpose. That corn of Ayn Anderson's is awfully late. Jack Nelson seeded oats there 3 years running. Wouldn't you think he'd want to give that ground a break and maybe rotate to alfalfa?
Wow.
That stand of Timothy looks mighty fine. Looks mighty thin, if you ask me. Mm. No one was asking her, of course. We didn't care about lush stands of corn and oats and hay. Not on this day when we were ranging in the wider world. The fields and farmsteads looked so transient flying by, so poorly founded in the landscape. Surely not strong or deep enough to claim a person's whole long life. Hmm. To swallow generations of a family's time and energy and caring. Yet they did.
Hmm.
I knew they did. It could be quite disturbing, such a far-flung tour, lacking in purpose and clear destination. One had to realize that the world could be capricious with its tricks and chances, accidents of death and birth, hard choices like commitment to a place, or no commitment, rootlessness, and all the wild-eyed freedom that might bring. If Daddy stopped in town for root beer or a round of ice cream, big double-deckers, please, it was more than a happy splurge. It was an anchoring, a soothing pause that readied us for going home again.
Yeah, you got to get out of the cage once in a while and see the world. You do. Breathe the air. Change the routine.
Big adventure.
That's beautiful. And the great risk of those rocks flying up and cracking and the punctured tires. Your book, going back to your book just out here, we're going to have to wrap this up. The Crops Look Good, News from a Midwestern Family Farm. The main messages to your mind, what do we take away from the book? Besides a loving look at a lot of interesting people, what...
Well, I think the contrasts are so startling to the way we live now, and it's good to reflect back on that a bit for all the things that are better and not as good. I do think we've lost a lot, too.
What have we lost, principally? The family as a basic social unit?
Yes.
I think that's a big part of it.
I do think it's a big part. I think the feeling of commitment to place and community was so strong. We had to work together. People helped each other. I think there was a kind of community spirit and selflessness that has changed to a great extent.
Mm-hmm. And not for the better?
in my mind, we've lost something in that regard.
I want to close, if I may, with the closing of your book, actually, in the epilogue. You write, "I like to picture my mother, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles sitting around the kitchen table." They're all gone now, of course, but
yes,
sitting,
yes.
You like to picture them sitting around the kitchen table at the home place, talking over all they have achieved and endured, marveling at the changes they have witnessed in their time. "We should write a book," Helen exclaims. "Yes, yes, we should," Margaret agrees. "I wish I could tell them," this is your voice, Sarah, "I wish I could tell them that they did write a book."
Mm-hmm.
You did it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Lovely.
Thank
lovely,
you.
Lovely. Thank you, Sarah DeLuca. Wonderful job putting these wonderful memories together. And they're between the covers of a book, and they're not going to be taken away from us by a delete button.
Thank right. you, Stan. It
Thank
was,
you.
It was a real pleasure to be here.
A couple of signings. You're going to be in the area here. Some book signings, right? Do you want to get those on the air here before we go?
Oh, yes.
All right. Okay.
Yes.
Let's do that if you can.
Okay.
Can you find it?
Well,
I think I thought you had it right at hand here. Okay, here we go.
Well, Milltown Public Library.
Milltown, Wisconsin Public Library.
Thursday, April 23 at 6 p.m.
This that's, coming Thursday.
Yes, that's my hometown.
Yep, okay.
Friday, April 24 at Valley Bookseller right here in Stillwater. Mm-hmm. That's 5 p.m.
Right, next Friday. Okay.
And Folsom House in Taylor's Falls on Saturday, the 25th at 5 p.m.
You're going to be a busy lady.
Yes, I am.
Show up and chat with Sarah DeLuca, and I'm sure you'll be reading from your books, too.
That'd yes, I will.
Right,
thank you.
Thank you so much, folks.
Okay.
We're going to take a break, come in here, and talk to our buddy Brent Peterson from the I got Wisconsin on my mind here, the Minnesota Historical, Washington County Historical Society, right here in Minnesota. There, Kyle, I finally got that one out. We'll be right back. You finally found it, that old photograph of your grandmother that you've always wanted to share with your grandchildren, but it's torn, cracked, and faded. Well, don't despair. Bring it in to Images of the Past in Stillwater. They specialize in restoring and preserving memories for future generations. So when you bring your old photos to Images of the Past, you can share that beautiful photograph with your grandchildren. You can see examples at klbbradio.com. Keyword, photo. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past. Join your community in April 2015 as we read Love Medicine by Minnesota author Louise Erdrich. The Big Read in the St. Croix Valley is one book, one community program that brings together residents from throughout the valley around a common book. This year's programming will include a variety of literary, visual, and performing arts opportunities centered on themes found in Love Medicine. Valley Bookseller is providing a 15% discount on the title in April. Valley Bookseller, 217 Main Street, North Stillwater. Great books. Great people.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
Kelton the Viking here again for Viking Meadows. If there's anything us Vikings love as much as swinging the clubs, it's meat and beer. And Viking Meadows has a golf, beer, and brat special. From 11 to 5 on Fridays, get 18 holes of golf, a powered cart, a beer, and a brat for only $30. That's right, $30, Fridays, 11 to 5 only. Remember, Viking Meadows is just a half mile east of Highway 65 on my favorite road, Viking Boulevard. Beer and brat Fridays at Viking Meadows. Book a tee time at vikingmeadows.com.
We are back. Our good buddy Brent Peterson is here from the Washington County Historical Society. Brent is the top banana over there. We always look forward, Brent, as we like to say, looking backward with you.
Absolutely.
History is our great teacher. We just heard from Sarah DeLuca, who's written a wonderful piece of history.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the book.
It's a great book. You should read it, too. You can see it. I can show it to you.
Oh,
right
well,
here,
thank you.
You need to read it, too.
I think I might even try to do
you
that.
You do read, don't you?
I only write them. I don't read them.
You have a cabin up in that area where her grandparents...
we're in Barron County.
Okay, well,
this is... Just right next door.
Kind of a barren existence.
Exactly.
Well, I've got to ask you, what's new at the Washington Washington County. There's something about this Boutwell, this historic house that's been the subject of a effort to save it and tear it down. the back and forth, the tug this way, the tug that way. Where this is a Washington County house.
Yes.
This was a religious figure, was it?
Yeah, Reverend Boutwell was actually a missionary to this area back in the 1830s to the Ojibwe nations. He was up at Lake Pekegama. He was at Leech Lake. But I guess he got he's really known for when he went with Henry Schoolcraft on a government expedition up the Mississippi River. Boutwell was there to kind of look for mission sites. But eventually they discovered that what they thought was the source of the Mississippi wasn't. So then they paddled up this other stream and into another lake. And Schoolcraft asked Boutwell for a Latin term, meaning the true source or true head. And Boutwell gave him Veritas Caput. Meaning in Latin, meaning truth and head. And so Schoolcraft, of course, being probably a government official, he took the second syllable of the first word and the first syllable of the second word and put them together and created the word
Itasca.
Yes.
Okay.
So it was Reverend Boutwell who helped name the true source of the Mississippi River back at that time. He went, he was what was called a sky pilot. He would go across to lumber camp,
preacher man. Yep.
Every Sunday, find another lumber camp. It is thought that he preached the first word here in what is now Stillwater. He settled in Stillwater Township on that property back in 1847. He helped to establish the first Presbyterian church in Stillwater, a congregation that is still very vibrant today.
Wow.
And he was the first chaplain to the Minnesota Territorial Senate.
Okay.
So his history, I mean, he laid the groundwork with the Ojibwe Nation for treaties, for the government, for even settlement now of what we call Minnesota. So
a house identified with him is worthy of being saved.
I believe this house is as worthy as being saved as the Alexander Ramsey house, the as Henry Sibley's house, and probably even James J. Hill house, because without Boutwell, they wouldn't have been here.
Wow. So how goes the battle to save it? I saw something in the paper a couple of weeks ago.
It's still standing.
Yeah.
There are
boarded up, though, isn't it? Derelict.
It needs to be a little bit more boarded up. That's what you saw in the paper.
Yeah, okay.
And it needs to be cleaned up a little bit, but I do believe there are things in the background with this, with saving it and restoring it and placing it on the National Register of Historic Places where it should be.
What are the odds of saving it? How do you rate them right now?
Right now, maybe 50-50.
Oh, boy.
Maybe next week it'll be a little bit better than that.
Really?
Well,
okay.
There are...
You're sitting on some information.
I am sitting on... I'm sitting on something.
That's a chair.
That's a chair.
Chair. It's only got three legs.
But
there he goes. Okay. All right.
But it's things are going to be more hashed out
next
week.
Okay, Brent. You're fighting the good fight.
Is a fight worth fighting.
Yeah, I know. And you're not one of these people, these, you know, preservationists who see everything and they, we got to save that.
Nope.
We got to save that. Nope. We got to save that little thing over there. No.
Well, in my opinion, you know, every structure has its history.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who lives in these houses that you see around here have their own history. And without them, we wouldn't have our community as it is.
That's true.
I do wish that more of the... houses that are being torn down that would be saved, because a couple of things, the history, but also tearing something down and put it in a landfill just kind of seems wasteful,
doesn't it?
And it could really just help the communities in as a whole, not only in Stillwater, but we're talking about there was the Bielenberg house in Woodbury.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Woodward house down in Cottage Grove recently. There's been some up in Forest Lake that have been gone down. And these things really need to be looked at carefully before you put a wrecking ball down.
Yeah, really. And we'll never see this kind of construction and architecture again. You couldn't afford to build, in many cases,
exactly,
a place like this, because the stonework, the millwork, the woodwork,
all that. I mean, if you would see how thick... you talk about one piece of white pine piece of wood. When we redid our house, the pine boards were, you know, inch and a half thick by 16 feet long, all one piece. It's amazing. And, you know, we have a...
Now you can hold a piece of wood up to the light and see through it.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
When a 2x4 was really 2x4.
Yeah.
And there is a finite number of 19th century homes. Once they're gone, you can't build a 19th century home.
You can't.
It's the 21st century.
That's right, right.
So,
Brent Peterson, you do good work. What else is new at the Washington County Historical Society? We're watching the new bridge unfold here across the St. Croix by Oak Park Heights.
That's putting along. We're a part of a group that is putting together a history of the Stillwater Lift Bridge. We hope to have that published by the end of the year.
Good. That's the landmark bridge that dates to the 1930s.
Right.
Here, the one that goes up and down, and when the cables break, it does not go up and down.
Exactly. And when trucks get stuck underneath it, nobody goes anywhere.
Yeah.
But
it's a landmark. It is the landmark of Stillwater.
What's fun about this book, though, Stan, is we actually go back. Before you can talk about the lift bridge, you got to talk about river crossings in general. So we went all the way back and talked about, you know, the ferry crossings before they had the bridge in 1876. And we discovered the pontoon bridge, that the first bridge that was across here, was very unique and very cutting edge at the time. This gentleman named John Lawler, who built it, was a nationally recognized bridge builder. And this was a new form of construction. It was quite interesting and unique, and it got national attention when it was opened.
All right. So we have a book coming out on the lift bridge, huh?
On the lift bridge.
Okay. How soon? And who's doing it?
Myself.
You're writing it.
Myself, Nancy Goodman, and Don Amson.
Oh, that's those three good ones here.
So we got a few heavy hitters and me in there. So,
what's the title?
Right now it's called The Stillwater Lift Bridge, The Ups and Downs of an Iconic Structure.
I knew there'd be ups and downs of that title. How did I know that?
But of them, you know.
But you're serious, aren't you?
I am very serious.
All right, good.
It is going to be a great book, widely illustrated, especially with the construction of the lift bridge. It's just great.
Some crayon drawings by you, too.
Well, of course.
Okay, that'll be good.
You know, I send those to you every week.
You do, and I still can't understand. That's okay. We're going to take a break here. Brent Peterson of the Washington County Historical Society. Come back with more and see what the society's been up to right after this.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
The Stillwater area is most fortunate to be the home of Valley Bookseller, located right on Main Street in downtown. If you or anyone you know likes to read, this is the bookstore for you. Books, book clubs, book specials, book events, and more books. Check out their website at valleybookseller.com to see events, special sales, and staff recommendations. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books. Great people. 217 Main Street North, Stillwater. They've been sitting on that shelf for years. Those special memories of your childhood on slides, videotapes, or 8mm film. You want to share them, but you don't have a way to do it. Now is the time to let images of the past do it for you, and you'll have those special memories to share with the family. Images of the Past can transfer your memories to DVD to be enjoyed anytime by the whole family. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past and at imagesofthepast.com.
700. That's 700. Now, normally when I say this, you'll remember the numbers of a famous British spy. But I'm asking you to remember 7009. You see, Quickfire Pizza now delivers to Stillwater. But you need to know the number. 439-7009. Quickfire Pizza. Baked in just minutes, then delivered to you in Stillwater. So remember, 7009. Because Quickfire Pizza now delivers to Stillwater. 651-439-7009.
We're back with our buddy Brent Peterson, top guy over the Washington County Historical Society. Always good things going on there, always. Brent is among those people who make history entertaining and interesting. Not only, we know it's important, but there's no law that says you can't have fun studying history and talking about it and finding out about it. And
history is fun.
It is fun. It is fun. And as we often say, and I said it earlier in this half hour, it is our best teacher. If we just bother to look at what's gone before, we can figure out why we are where we are now and where we might be headed or where we don't want to be headed.
Exactly.
Because we can draw from the lessons of history.
That's
so if we just bother to open our eyes and ears and minds, we can do it. You've got lots of good things going on. This is a busy season for the Historical Society. An open house coming up?
Yes, we got an open house. The Warden's House Museum here on North Main Street is always has a open house to kick off their season. So our open house this year is Sunday, April 26th, okay, from noon until 4. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a lot of our new exhibits opening. We have a great new exhibit about some buildings that were here and that have been torn down. We have the same exhibit shows the ones that were saved.
Mm.
So it kind of gives you a good perspective on what was torn down, what was saved, what those saved buildings, like the historic courthouse, has done for the community after it was saved. So it's a great little exhibit. I'm sure people will enjoy that. We're all going to have, of course, the an exhibit that talks about the flood of 1965.
Well, yes, 1965.
And speaking of that, that is the anniversary is tomorrow. The river crested here in Stillwater on April 18th, 1965,
and downtown Stillwater was saved from floodwaters because
of the teenagers died.
Teenagers, I think a couple of the inmates from the prison came down.
There were a few of those as well, I understand. But the Stillwater got down and dirty and said, "Okay, we gotta protect downtown."
Right.
And with the businessmen, everybody working together, and if you talk to anyone who ever worked on that dike, they will tell you that it was one of those rare moments in history that people came from everywhere and worked hand in hand for a common goal. And this 5,000-foot-long, 8-foot-high dike protected the downtown Stillwater. Now, there are temporary dikes built throughout Minnesota that year, but Stillwater's was the only one to have the water stay away.
Right.
The other ones all collapsed. And it was known as the teenagers' dikes because teenagers got out of school, got down there, worked, 12, 16 hours. The Red Cross was down there giving away food. Mm-hmm. And if people came from the Twin Cities to help, there were even cots at the armory for people to take a little nap if they needed to.
Just give kids a day out of school. They'll build a dike for you, no problem.
Exactly. So,
they did great work.
There was a sign painted and put on top of the dike. It said Teenager's Dike, and we have that sign.
Wonderful. I think there's a photo of it in the Pioneer Press today.
Yes,
or the Star Tribune. Yeah. I think it's the Pioneer Press today. And they found one of the teenagers who's doesn't look much like a teenager anymore, he's one of the heroes. One of the heroes of the time.
And, of course, one of the main people interviewed in that article was...
That wouldn't be you, would it?
No, it's
your
not.
Your father.
My father.
Your father.
Yeah, my father was...
Was he one of the inmates who came down?
Well, we won't...
No. And by the way, the inmates did help. They did.
Absolutely.
They did.
My father is now the only survivor of the members of the city council at that time. So he was his first year on the city council. He had to deal with this.
Welcome to the city council,
exactly,
Mr. Peterson.
Exactly.
Yes.
But
then you were born, and his life just kept getting.
I was filling sandbags. I was filling diapers. But
are we working on a time delay, Kyle? cut that out of the tape. We're live. It's too late now. It's too late now.
I didn't say that.
Well, okay. So
but
the anniversary.
That's a
great
exhibit. And afterwards, after the dike held, the Hooley Supermarket minted some coins, medallions, in honor of the Teenager's Dike. And we have some of those on display.
Really?
And some great photographs, color photographs that were taken. We even have a lot of photos also of what happened down in Bayport. We have some of Afton. We also have some Cottage Grove because the Mississippi River rose quite high as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poor Washington County was hit on both sides that year with floods.
Right.
And it doesn't look like it's going to happen this year, but you never know.
One thing about this radio station you're sitting in right now, what floor are we sitting on?
Second floor.
So if we have to, we can take a boat and come in through the windows.
Yeah,
here.
Absolutely.
And, we're not street level, are we? Huh?
No.
So you'll always be high and dry here, Kyle. You're safe, okay? Isn't that reassuring, huh? All right, so I think we're on the cusp of baseball season, aren't we?
And
the society has vintage baseball. You guys
baseball.
Dress up like 60s?
Yeah. Well, actually, I went down with my kids down to spring training down in Fort Myers. I had to get warmed up for this current season. And so I had to teach the twins something to do, and that's why they started 0-3. Anyway.
Yeah, I noticed.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks a lot, Brent.
But vintage baseball season is going to be underway in May. We're going to take on those rascals down in Afton, those Afton Red Sox, you know, they're nefarious and all sorts of things.
Harsh language, Brent. Harsh language you're using.
It is terrible, but those guys can play ball. So we got to be on our top tip-top game.
In other words, you're going to have to really cheat.
That means we're going to have to recruit some more people. So what you doing?
I don't know. I think I'm busy that weekend.
Okay.
What were the rules? What are the you're using the 1860 rules. These are actual rules.
Actual rules.
What are some of them, please?
Well, actually, you know, pitching is underhand. There's no balls or strikes called, but you can swing and miss three times to strike out.
Okay.
And the bases paths are 90 feet apart, just like they are today.
All right.
But we play the bound rule, which is very good on your hands since there are no gloves. Baseball gloves weren't invented until the 1870s.
Wow.
So the bound rule.
A hot grounder is going to stay with you for a while.
Oh, yeah. It also changes the course of the direction of fingers
and the color of your fingers.
Yes. But the bound rule is if you hit the ball and the fielder catches it on the fly or the first bounce, the batter is out.
Oh, first bounce and you're out?
Yeah,
Kyle, that sounds pretty weird, doesn't it?
Well, it helps the hands a little bit, too.
All right. That sound interesting to you? Would you like to play?
It definitely sounds a little easier.
Well, our big tournament, you know, is during logjam days.
Okay.
So we have seven teams coming, and a new team from Chisholm, you know.
Chisholm.
Yeah,
I was told, don't pronounce it Chisholm. It's Chisholm.
Chisholm.
Chisholm, or they'll chase you right out of the state.
Oh, well.
Now, your league involves some other states, doesn't it?
Oh, like, we play people from Ohio.
Yeah.
We play people from Wisconsin. They even have a team.
Now, be nice.
Well,
Wisconsin's a nice place.
Oh, you have some cheese out there.
Brent.
And then,
be careful when you walk out the door.
There's a lot of great teams from Michigan, too.
Mm-hmm.
We love playing those guys.
Okay.
And it's everybody just loves the game, loves history, and you play it for either the love of the sport, the love of history, but the respect is always there.
Or to get out of the house and away from...
Well, I'm usually kicked out of the house.
I know you are. What about the vintage baseball uniforms? Do you have
the uniforms come in a couple different styles. What we do is we wear the shield style, and there's it's like a fireman's shirt, a jersey from the 1850s, 1860s, and we have our logo on the front, and I've got to throw a good shout-out because our uniforms were made by my wife. Handmade.
Chris is great.
Yeah. So she made those for us, and we actually need a few more made if she's listening.
You're as subtle as a blowtorch, aren't you, Brian?
You know, when you got it, you got to do it, you know. So that type of thing is great. And we have hats, and it's just wonderful.
What else is coming up that we should know about this summer? It's always a busy, busy season.
Oh, we have a great lecture series, not only in at the Warden's Home, but also up at the Hay Lake School. Mm-hmm. One of the lectures is going to be done by Sean Paulus, who is our site manager at the Warden's House.
Okay.
Sean is going to talk about the unique histories of some of the older prisoners at the old state prison.
Wow.
We always talk about the younger brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
We
all
know about the Youngers and the James Boys and all this kind of stuff, and there's been books written about them, and they talk about it, but what about the other guys?
Yeah,
you know?
What about them? Equal time for the other inmates.
You got the people who tried to escape out of the prison or just kind of walked out of the prison with no one stopping them. Why not walk out? And, you know, so they did that, and some of the other guards, some of the history of the wardens. It's just fantastic history that Sean is going to delve into.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, I don't know when this one's going to be, but sometime in May, and it's 1 hour is just not long enough.
Mm.
And another great thing we have coming up, especially we're going to kick this off on April 26th at the open house, and you're the first to know about this.
Thank you.
We are going to hold a raffle.
You too, Kyle. You're in on this.
No, Kyle.
Don't listen.
We are going to hold a raffle, and the raffle is for the winner and a guest to go along with the Johnsdale Paranormal Group as they do a paranormal investigation of the Warden's House.
Whoa.
So at night,
ghosts, spooks.
They'll go and see if there's any paranormal spiritual activity at the Warden's House.
Well, you work there, so there must be.
Well, no, I'm not there right now.
Not there, okay.
Okay, but it is a fantastic type of...
okay, that sounds great.
It is fun. They do a great job.
When will this be? What's the date?
The date is... April 26th.
Okay.
That is when we're kicking off the raffle, and it ends in August, and we're going to have a great time, and come on down on the 26th to get started on that.
And you'll have a ghost of a chance for a lot of fun.
All
right, ladies and gentlemen, Brent Peterson. Thank you, Brent, very much. Washington County Historical Society. Boo to you. Okay, right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend. Catch you Monday right after the news at noon with the All Request Show. Bye-bye.
This is where your music and memories live. Club 1220.
KLBP.
Stillwater, Minneapolis, St. Paul.